Welcome back to the Resonant Life Podcast. We are your hosts, Dr. Layla Doolittle.
And Dr. Maximilian. And today we do enjoy that interview with Dr. Mark Devine, who is a retired Navy SEAL commander, a renowned leadership expert, and a best-selling author who has spent decades of training the world's top warriors, entrepreneurs, and change makers to master their mind, body, and spirit.
Through his SEAL Fit and Unbeatable Mind programs, he has transformed how individuals build mental toughness, emotional resilience, and conscious leadership. With advanced degrees in both finance and global leadership, and over 30 years of Zen meditation and breathwork practice, Dr. Devine brings a rare integration of military discipline, ancient wisdom, and modern neuroscience to the conversation. He is on a mission to awaken the courageous, compassionate leader within each of us. And today, he joins us for a powerful exploration of personal evolution, purpose, and unlocking our highest potential. And we are so excited to have Mark Devine here with us on the podcast. It's so exciting to share this conversation with you today.
Well, I'm super excited to be here. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Yes. Looking forward to it.
It's such a phenomenal honor to have you here. Actually, your book, The Way of the SEAL, actually initiated me to seeing peak performance in a totally different way. Not just being the hardest, being the toughest, being the alpha, but literally listening to more perspective and seeing all of the facets that actually performance builds. And in your latest book, Uncommon, you're not just sharing what success is. You're looking to the extraordinary. What actually are the new frontiers of being extraordinary? What are the virtues as well as the ideals to Right. step up from just performance to something that is extraordinary?
Yeah. Well, the framework for Uncommon, which I actually introduced in The Way of the SEAL, is integrated development. And I use the five mountains as the metaphor. And the five mountains are your physicality, physical health, mental development, emotional development, intuitional and awareness development, and spiritual development. I use the term Kokoro for spiritual, primarily because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, everyone has a lot of different understandings or perspectives on what spiritual means. And Kokoro, though, you can precisely define. It's a warrior, Japanese warrior term that means whole mind or merging your heart and mind into your actions. So think about that. You have heart. Now, what does that mean? You have mind. What does that mean? And what in action? So you have actually the three primary paths to awakening are through the heart, the mind, and action, karma yoga, bhakti yoga, and jnana yoga. And so whoever wrote this or figured this word out understood that this idea of merging heart, mind, and action is an integrated approach to awakening. Mm-hmm. So that's what the spiritual mountain is all about. So in the common, I introduced the concept as a framework for development. Mm-hmm. And I use that in my training and my coaching clients. But with Uncommon, I wanted to go deeper on each one of those mountains and really provide a lot of kind of rationale and kind of science-based backing and also some practical tools so people can experience very rapidly the benefits for, you know, taking these aspects of yourselves and instead of looking at them as separate things, like you drag your body to the gym and that's physical, you know, or you know, you try to have the perfect diet. And then spiritual is maybe going to church on Sunday, right? And emotional is usually nothing for most people, but you know, unless your wife drags you to therapy, it's a good right? To look at these all as just different aspects of your body mind and to bring them all together into a training plan. And that training plan has daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and even annual things that you can do. And when you begin to activate that development at that integrated or holistic level, you get accelerated growth and massive transformations. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, I was excited to bring it out because I think, you know, people are really hungry for like a real path, right? A real, you know, template for development because there's so much junk out there.
There's so much stuff
on the surface. Anyways.
I love that.
And especially perfectly described, and especially when it comes to the ideals and the virtues of the archetype that you're trying to elaborate on. How can the audience imagine that archetype of that new leader that actually steps up and leads from a different perspective, especially when around there is so much noise, so much turmoil, and like you as a Navy SEAL knew it, how is it working? What would be the image you want to present?
Well, imagine like a martial arts master who was also a Zen master, which is actually how I got my start at 21 when I was in New York working on becoming a certified public accountant and getting my MBA at NYU Business School. And I started a martial art there. And the founder of this style of karate, his name was Tadashi Nakamura, was an absolute master, right? He was very, very accomplished martial artist. But he was also a Zen teacher, Zen practitioner, Zen teacher. So what you have there is this idea of the hard and the soft combined, right? Mm-hmm. The yin and the yang, or the yang being the hard and the yin being the soft. He found his softness and his receptivity and his creativity, his intuition, his spontaneity, primarily through his Zen training, through training of the mind and the heart, right? But he didn't do it at the expense of, the hardcore physical training, right? The training, polishing, wax on, wax off, a lot of push-ups, a lot of fighting, kata, dance, all that kind of stuff. And so that was where I first observed the wholeness that accrues from developing the hard and the soft simultaneously, or not sacrificing one for the other. And our culture, Western culture, has a massive bias toward action and individuality. It also has a massive bias toward hierarchy, and that hierarchy that is, flavored with paternalism. Mm-hmm. So those are all yang qualities, and a lot of shadow or dysfunctional yang qualities at that. Whereas the yin qualities is inclusivity, receptivity, right? More the motherly or maternally kind of qualities of creation and healing. And we're trained in the West to think, for men, that those are kind of weak, right? And there couldn't be anything further from the truth, right? What it makes you, if you have those qualities as a man, it makes you whole. It doesn't make you weak.
Exactly.
Right? And same thing as a woman, right? As a woman, if you have qualities of the yang, where you can step into courage and take care of business and be what we call sheepdog strong, then it makes you whole as well, right? It doesn't make you a man, right? Or a tomboy. So we have these really distorted views and these imbalances in our culture. And that becomes part of the training of your own individual matrix, right? So how you are, listener, trained. I have this saying that if you're not training your mind, someone else is training it for you.
100%.
The biggest trainer of minds is culture. That includes media, social media, your peers, and then the influencers who are pulling the levers of that culture. Obviously, political establishments, the academic educational institutions. Look at how that's played out. What's going on in the world today with all the DEI and woke stuff, which that's all just training, right? It's conditioning.
Yes.
And then back to your family. And then even at a broader cultural level, the influence of you would say that the social political structures, like obviously whether you're a collectivist culture like China or Russia or an individualistic culture, and then the church, right? And your alignment with that ideology. All of that is just training. And it's creating belief systems, mental models. It's creating patterns. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those patterns, mental models and belief systems, and have a shadow side, and are creating subconscious negative programming within us. And so ultimately you don't, people love to think they have free will, but you don't have free will unless you examine all that. I mean, that's why Socrates says an unexamined life is not worth living, because you're an automaton. You're a robot.
Yes.
And people don't realize that they're just playing out the script that someone else has written for them, or culture or society or some government has written for them. And so if you want true freedom, which is what I'm helping people find, they've got to slow down enough and develop those yin qualities of being able to turn within, to look within, and to settle the mind, quiet the mind, and then to be able to take a look at the story, develop some space between you and your thoughts, you and your story, so you can see that you are not that story. That story is something that just is there. It's a bunch of ideas. And then you can ask if those ideas serve you anymore. And oftentimes they don't. They're negative. They're fear-based. They're creating anxiety. They're creating more separation. And they're locking you in limitation. And so you look at that and say, no, that's not my story.
Wow.
That's not my story. Okay. I mean, this played out exactly as I described there in while I was studying with Nakamura, because it wasn't the karate itself that helped open my mind. It was sitting in silence on that Zen bench. And he had a Zen class on Thursday evenings. I started training with him on Thursday evenings with a small group of other black belts. And I was just a white belt at the time. And I really enjoyed it a lot. And I have my theories of why I enjoyed it, but partly it was because of him and his energy. I really trusted him. I respected him. And so I was like, okay, if he says do this and there's going to be good that comes from it, then I'm going to do that. And I did it long enough, and I took it up as a daily practice. I bought my own little wooden Zazen bench, and I started to have some pretty profound experiences within, I'd say 9 months. It seemed to me pretty, 9 months is like a turning point in any like real deep training program of the mind. Because that's when you're going to start seeing some serious results. And I had these moments where I suddenly had this like shift in perspective where I realized I wasn't my thoughts, but I could see the thoughts as if slightly from a distance. Right. So I was developing metacognition, but it was in real time as opposed to like reflective journaling, you know, like how did things go last week? And I began to see that the story that I was living that led me to be, you know, there in New York working for Coopers and Lybrand, which is now PricewaterhouseCoopers, and getting my MBA at NYU and getting my CPA, all of these things, which everyone thinks is really good, were not me. They weren't good for me. It wasn't my story, right? It was a story that I had adopted, but it wasn't my authentic self story. It came from my parents and from my culture and from my, you know, my undergraduate school, Colgate, which is a pretty decent academic institution. And everyone from there is heading off to Wall Street and, you know, and banking and stuff like that. And so I was kind of conditioned to think that was good. And climbing the corporate ladder was good. And making a lot of money was good. And I'm not saying it's bad, but it wasn't necessarily right for me at that time. I never would have come to those conclusions had I not slowed down, learned how to still my mind and to look within, which is what meditation is.
That is brilliant. Thank you so, so very much for sharing. And especially what stood out about the story. It is very similar to mine. I started as a corporate lawyer and felt like the classical way, having the success, being the alpha, having that peak performance. But it felt so empty. There was just like no meaning. And what you discovered through the meditation, that stillness, that space where you can actually discover, why am I doing this?
Right.
And that is the first step to discover then the purpose. And when you then shared about being still in a noisy environment and listening to what the thoughts that you're actually having, are they really yours? Or are they just a programming? And I talk a lot about the entanglement of focus, coming back to the concept in quantum physics, where there is the entanglement. As soon as two particles match, they stay interconnected. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we are connected to an external force only, this becomes our identity, because we are inextricably linked and have a commitment to match that frequency setting all the time. And we don't know it if we are not aware. So let's play through your day. When you wake up, how do you remain that stillness, that clarity, and that space? And could you also share like your favorite practice, like for 2 or 3 minutes, so our audience sees and feels how you're doing it?
Oh, that's great. So I have a core practice just like you guys in the morning. And I also have one in the evening. And then I have things I do during the day. So at the biggest level, you have to look at each day as an event, right? And one of the Dharma talks that Nakamura gave after his Zen sessions, he wrote down in his little black you know, chalk on his little black chalkboard. He wrote one day, one lifetime.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And so you have to think about each day as a lifetime. You have a lifetime of opportunity to learn and grow if you pay attention. You have a lifetime of opportunity to serve, right? Even if you just serve, you know, and help one person, right? That's enough. And you have a lifetime of opportunity to discover who you really are and why you're on this planet. Just like Buddha said, you can find enlightenment with a single breath if you pay close enough attention. So one day, one lifetime, it's similar to the Navy SEALs admonition that the only easy day was yesterday. And what they're saying there is
totally true.
Don't rest on your accomplishments of yesterday. Today's your day to get busy and make it happen, right? to prove yourself again. So that means if today is the most important day of my life, because like it undeniably is, because it's the only day you have, you know, and tomorrow might not come, you know, you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. We hope, but we don't know. Right. Yesterday is gone. So it's just purely memory. It slipped into memory. So what you have is right now, right? Today. And then now, this moment. So then the question is, what are you going to do about it? Like this, if this is the most important day of your life, which it is, what are you going to do about it? Well, just like a Navy SEAL wouldn't just, you know, oh, here's your mission. Okay, jump on the helicopter. Let's go. Right? People think it's that way. No. We prepare. Right? Mm-hmm. First of all, our whole career is preparing, learning all the basic skills and everything and the advanced skills. But then when that energy gets directed at a specific mission, then we prepare for that. And so if today is the most important day, that's your mission. What do I do? If I'm going to go do this mission and succeed, I need to prepare. So I call this winning in your mind before you step foot on the battleground. Right? That's the morning ritual. Right? It's the most important thing. It starts the moment you regain consciousness from your sleep cycle, the moment. Mm-hmm. So generally, like I'll go through roughly what my morning ritual is. And you'll find elements are pretty common. I mean, not common, but they're not unusual. But then there's some things that are unusual.
I guess like they're uncommon.
They might be uncommon. Right? So the first uncommon thing is this idea that it starts the moment you wake up. Yeah. So the moment you regain consciousness, you got to remember who you are and why you're here.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Right? Because you know, you've come through, you might have like latent dream memories. You might even have some energy from yesterday. You're like obsessing about a project or work unfinished, or, you know, you're dealing with some drama and your mind's going to immediately go back into that energy. You're like, we're saying about resonance, you know, when you have this kind of resonance with a lot, you know, a big energy in your life. It could be a person, it could be a job, right? It could be what's going on in the political environment. It's going to pull your consciousness right back into that, right? So you've got to be on guard. And we call it first thoughts, first words. And your first thoughts and your first words are to yourself. So if you're just having ruminations, those are just first thoughts. And 9 times out of 10, those ruminations are going to spin into something that is really not productive and is not going to lead you to the success you're looking for that day. So you've got to ensure that that doesn't happen. And anytime that you are talking to yourself, like with an affirmation or you dumbass, like, or why are you having, you know, that was a terrible nightmare. Mm-hmm. You know, what's wrong with, you know, whatever. That kind of internal rumination is first words. And first words are usually most people to themselves. Mm-hmm. So your first thoughts, you want to curate them, right, to ward off the negative programming, you know, the getting back into what I call the fear loops. And you want to direct those first thoughts toward positive, you know, productive ideas about who you are and what you're doing on this planet. Right. So we have a future image that we develop of our future selves. That's a good place to direct it to. And our first words are going to be positive affirmations. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I got five affirmations that I kind of cycle through, and I'm charging my mind up with that positive energy and positive imagery. And I'm preventing it from, you know, sliding into negative territory. So now I'm establishing a firm foundation, like vibrationally, or from a conscious level, like, okay, this is the platform. I mean, we can only go up from here, but I'm not starting down in the, you know, in the pit, right, and having to drag myself out later on. And all that literally is there while I'm just deep breathing, right? So I'm just doing nice, deep diaphragmatic breathing as I wake up slowly, and I'm curating the quality of my thoughts. Mm-hmm. First thoughts, first words. That's the beginning of the practice.
Love that.
Then I'll get up, use the restroom, and I'll have a glass of water. Fresh water. I have hydrogenized water. This is important for the physical mountain because you lose a lot of water. You get dehydrated at night, and your body, as you guys know, is like a battery, right? It's got chemicals and electrical processing systems that rely on water, and 78% water. And so you've got to kind of like top off the battery.
I like that. Not starting in minus. Yeah.
Right. You don't want to be at a deficit there either. And also this begins the gratitude practice, right? Mm-hmm. So which is an extension of the first thoughts, because you want your thoughts to be positive. One of the most powerful practices for positivity is gratitude. So to be grateful for the water.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, water is life. I mean, everything is conscious is life, but water is a very powerful form of life. And so you're drinking life. Mm-hmm. And when you charge that water up, we know this from the Japanese, right? Water, right? Yes. If you talk to it positively,
absolutely,
right? It's got a beautiful structure to it. But if you scream at it, then it suddenly gets all chaotic.
Yes.
Discordant, right? Just like you do the same thing with a plant, right? It's all water, mm-hmm, and life. And if you love it and you talk nicely to it, it just flourishes. But if you were to yell at it every day, you'd die. Human beings the same way. So anyways, that's part two. Drink that fresh water with gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will head back to my training space, which frankly for me is sitting cross-legged on my bed. And I have one of those pillows with the arms so I can sit up straight. And my wife and I do this practice together, by the way. So a couple that practices together stays together. Right?
Yes.
It's a very 100%. Powerful thing for a couple to do. So then I'll break out my journal and we continue the gratitude with, just kind of stream of consciousness and some reflective questions and, really thinking in a very detailed way, not like a list of things that you kind of repeat every day, but like what things happened yesterday that were really fun, really cool, that I could be super grateful for. And what's about to happen today? What about just this opportunity to serve today and to like do things like this podcast? Just be very grateful. And that continues to charge up, right, your mind with positive energy. And also beginning to get the heart involved, right? Because as you know, I'm big on this idea that the body is the mind, right? It's just partitioned a little bit into these different brain centers, right? The brain in your head, the brain in your heart, the brain in your gut, but your entire enteric nervous system, body, skin, fascia, everything is all part of your mind system, your sensory apparatus. And so we want to be able to train different aspects of it. Getting back into the five mountains, people say, well, how do you train intuition? Well, you got to be able to listen into and really understand the messages from your gut and from your heart. Those are your, gut is instinctual intuition and like safety signals, and your heart is empathic intuition, right? This is how those in your vicinity are doing. And the more you do heart work, the further out you can project your field of awareness. And then your brain is going to have the ability to experience direct perception and insight. So the really different ways that we experience intuition. But I digress. So we do the gratitude practice to begin to open the heart, right? And this then, as the practice opens up and flourishes, we get into forgiveness and loving kindness. So we're working on, remember I said, merge heart, head, heart, and hands. Merge heart, mind, and actions, right? So this is a way we go through the mind to get into the heart. We think our way to open our heart. This is the Western way, because we're so hyper trained mentally. So we have to think our way to open our heart. At least guys do. So after this, I will then go into what I call my box breathing practice, but it's more than just breathing. It is breath work, but it's a container for a stacked practice. And I'll describe it real briefly. This is the way I do it, but this is an advanced practitioner. Beginners will do each one of these phases like separately until they kind of master it, and then they'll move on. So box breathing, we'll do a couple of rounds right now. Simply deep diaphragmatic nostril breathing. through the nose, mouth closed. And we're going to breathe in for, I train to get to a count of five and the hold for a count of five and exhale for a count of five and hold for a count of five. And those, each count is roughly a second. So that would be a 20 second breath, which is three breaths per minute. And what's nice about that is you do this every day for about 6 to 9 months and you will rewire your nervous system so that you're automatically breathing five count in and five count out when you're not box breathing. And that's six breaths per minute. And as you guys know, six breaths per minute is the optimal breathing pattern for health and longevity.
Exactly.
And I've been teaching this since like 2004, and they just discovered that a couple of years ago. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense to me because we've been doing that. So this deep diaphragmatic breathing is it's activating your diaphragm. It's slowing the breath down. You know, you're breathing through your nostrils, so you're stimulating the energy centers, the nadis, which are actually going to then start training your brain. So without even using your mind in any other way except for breathing, you're now stimulating and training your mind because your attention is now really controlled and focused on the breathing pattern itself. Because it takes effort to think, okay, you know, now I'm going to hold and I'm going to count. Right. And then I also teach people to literally visualize the box pattern as they breathe in, hold, breathe out, hold. So you've got three things going on here already. One is arousal control, right? Because that deep diaphragmatic breathing is massaging the vagus nerve, activating the parasympathetic rest digest function, which in most people has been atrophied. Fucking hyper arousal. I'm sure a lot of your clients, you got to start there.
Yes.
You got to get them de-stressed and, you know, they're all burned out. It's because we have so many stressors, so many distractions. We're running around being helicopter parents and doing this. And, and so we're always triggering the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic literally, it will atrophy. So we de-atrophy it. We bring it back online through this deep diaphragmatic breathing. And because we're adding the holds require concentration, right? And you have to like really pay attention to get the pattern in the holds. So now we're practicing attention control. And I just mentioned that attention is a big problem in our society. Like social media and texting and everything is really destroying people's ability to hold their attention. And so this practice has the ability to calm you down, which gives you more kind of clarity because your brain is going to calm down, and also the ability to control your attention, to be able to hold your attention where you want it instead of always be distracted. And the longer we practice, not in the terms of a single session, but over time, you're going to have the ability to hold your attention longer for longer and longer periods of time. And we call that concentration. So attention control is the ability to hold, you know, always stay on that one thing, but the ability to hold your attention on that one thing. It's concentration. So we've got arousal control, attention control, and concentration all happening. Now, when I start, I usually have people just focus on one of those three things. But as you can see, they're actually all going to be trained as part of this practice. And then, so I have people do that. And like I said, it's depending upon the training level, the health of the individual, right? Their life conditions. It could be a year that they just do that every day, 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening. And just remarkable things happen, like extraordinary health gains, deeper ability to remain focused and concentrate. And also that ability to suddenly quite remarkably open up to see your patterns and thoughts happens, right? So this is cool. Let me pause here. Mindfulness is kind of a rage right here in our country, but most people have no idea how to practice it and they fail at it. And it's because they haven't developed arousal control, attention control, and concentration. So their mind's bouncing all over the place and they're so merged with their thoughts that they're just sitting there thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And there are going to be some health benefits by sitting there thinking, but they're not going to get any real meditative mental training benefits. Yeah. So the progression in order to effectively practice mindfulness is get your physicality, your physical body de-stressed and healthy. We do that through exercise, through proper nutrition and sleep, right? That's the physical mountain. And physical mountain training begins also with box breathing, which activates that parasympathetic nervous system, rest and digest, and de-stresses the body. And that's all foundational to be able to hold your attention. So, and then you practice the attention control and concentration. And the longer you practice that, right, something happens, because anytime your mind will shift or split attention or bounce to something else, right, in the beginning, like, you could be lost in reverie for the entire thing and be like, whoa, you know, this is what I'm doing, right? They sit down and they think they're supposed to be all peaceful, but they just spend 20 minutes thinking. Well, you're trying to concentrate on one thing instead. So instead of just sitting there thinking, or hoping you're not thinking, or watching those thoughts, but you're really just thinking, you're trying to concentrate on one thing, and that's the box pattern. And so when you lose focus on it, it's a lot easier to not get lost in reverie, because you're sooner or later going to remember that you're supposed to be concentrating on that box.
Yes.
Right? And so then you snap it back and say, wait, I was supposed to focus on this box. And then you bring it back and you concentrate on the box, right? And then your attention wanders again. And then you're like, oh, I noticed my attention's wandering. Bring it back. Well, the longer you do this, and suddenly there's this, like, this lifting of a veil where you realize that, whoa, I keep noticing that my attention has been wandering or split. And I'm not, and so I bring those thoughts back. So who's this part of my being that is noticing? Because it's obviously not the thoughts, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to bring it back. I wouldn't be able to notice that my thoughts had wandered. Right? And so you have this massive epiphany that I am not my thoughts. Right. This is a sea change for people.
Yes.
This is like you could call it the first awakening. Awakening to the idea.
Yeah, 100%.
You are not your thoughts. You are not your stories. Holy shit. I get my life back. The opportunity. Back.
Yes.
Right.
I'm not the thought train. Yeah.
I'm not the thought train. But then you have to ask the question, if not that, then who am I?
Yes.
And that gets us to the perennial dangerous question. That was Ramana Maharshi's meditation. Who am I? So that's what happens over time, is you do attention, arousal control, attention control, concentration. Just do that, just do that, just do that. And then suddenly you're just going to open up and be like, oh, wow, I am the witness. I am not these thoughts. Those thoughts are happening. And at first you kind of go back and forth. Like, you merge with your thoughts and you're like, no, I'm not. I'm not my thoughts. I stay in witness. The more you practice, the less frequently this kind of back and forth happens. And then suddenly you have this permanent shift where you have the permanent state of witnessing. And you can also think, but you become much less reactionary, and you can begin to see how the programming conditioning has been acting in your life, because now there's this, all this space between stimulus and response, and you get to decide whether you want to respond that way or not. So you tend to get a lot quieter, much more humble, right? So you can see the leadership
all
qualities.
The good virtues.
Yeah, you see the virtues and leadership qualities of someone who has attained this level of freedom from their thinking, because they're really different. They're like Nakamura. It's very spontaneous. And the spontaneity wasn't like negative reactionary like my father's was. It was like perfect, right? It was the perfect thing at the perfect moment, because it was just flowing through him spontaneously. Yes. That is the outcome. And it's also a practice. You know, you could say, yeah, I'm practicing mindfulness, but really it's an outcome of a long period of practicing arousal control, attention control, and concentration. Now, so that's my practice. And I'll go through a couple rounds in a bit, but it doesn't end there, right? So when you get into this mindfulness phase, there is still content, right? I liken it. In fact, when I teach it, I have people imagine that they kind of, remember in The Way of the Seal, I talk about the sentinel setting up shop, right?
Yes.
You become the watcher, the sentinel. So you move over to the right hemisphere of your brain in your mind, like visualize, and you set up a seat, a chair, an observation post. And now you're looking over at the left hemisphere, what I call lefty. And that's where thinking is happening, right? All thoughts will not necessarily this way, but you can actually kind of feel like, well, thoughts are kind of originating kind of in that left hemisphere. Right side of your brain is contextual awareness. Left side is content, right? Analysis, strategic decision-making, accessing memory, that type of thing. So we want to develop this capacity through this mindfulness training to develop what I call simultaneous mind. Simultaneous mind is what I was describing a moment ago in different terms, that you have this witnessing awareness that is always watching, while simultaneously you're able to focus on a task and use good thinking powers. Right? Mm-hmm. You're not under the control of a monkey mind or some default mode network negative conditioning yet. You're in total control. Simultaneous mind. Well, when we get to this level of training, which might take a little while for some people, especially really super distracted people, then we can kind of do something we call, the Tibetans called, turn the flashlight around. So the flashlight of the awareness is that witness. And I'm looking outward toward my thinking, toward the outer world, because thought is a form, right? It's energy form. So it's no different than looking at a chair or, you know, a picture out there. It's just an internal form. So that's where your attention is going. It's going, oh, I'm witnessing what's going on out there, even if out there is in our mind at the form. So we want to turn the flashlight of awareness around to look at the formless. Mm-hmm. And of course, the formless can't be described because it has no form. There's no words that can really catch it, right? Mm-hmm. So the Eastern traditions, they use the terms Satchitananda, right? Being, consciousness, bliss or joy, or power, intelligence, and presence. Mm-hmm. And so these are aspects of the formless that we all have, right? The descriptions of the energy, life force, the aliveness in all of us, consciousness, God energy, Christ, whatever. We all have it. Every human being has it, or else we wouldn't be alive. We wouldn't be human. So that's when people say we are all one, what they're saying is we are all that. But we're also completely, utterly unique expressions of that oneness. So it's actually not two different things. It's not. That's why they say it's not duality. It's non-duality. Advaita, which is a Buddhist tradition, Advaita means not two. So we are that one energy, but it has multitudinous expressions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so you turn your attention toward that. And when you do that, it is quite willfully, like literally imagining yourself like turning that sentinel around, and you're looking for awareness itself. So you're asking awareness to become aware of itself. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing is, it will.
Yes. Yes.
Because it is your very nature. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up finding when you tap into this, or when you find this awareness of awareness itself, is then that's where you finally understand the concept of mu, the Japanese concept of mu, mu. No mind, because the outer mind, that form, like the form of thoughts, literally just disappears from view because you're not looking toward it anymore. You've like turned your back on it. And what you're experiencing is the formless, which can't be named, can't even be described, but terms that are useful is like vast spaciousness expanding in all directions. Or inky blackness is so black that it's blindingly bright.
The beauty of the void.
The beauty of the void, yes. Like, it's indescribably still. Yes. But you could be hearing, like, the roar of the ocean.
Yes.
Right? So it's really, really, like, people get really puzzled because you end up, like, reading spiritual text descriptions of this, and they all have these kind of like polarities or paradoxes to them. You know what I mean? Like, how can something be dark and light at the same time? Well, you just examine that thought and you realize, well, that can be, because darkness and light are, right? The darkness is just the absence of light. And so maybe the more I look, the less I'll see the darkness and the more light I'll see. And then, you know, you read descriptions of people who have their Kundalini opening and awakenings, and it's like explosive light that's brighter than the sun. And it's always with them, even when they sleep. It's a little distracting to sleep like that. You know, I can imagine. Right? So you're turning inward and looking. Now, this can happen where you're struggling. Like, I don't know what Mark's talking about. I don't know what I'm trying to. But and then suddenly one day you're just like, oh. You fall off. Because one of the other experiences is this timelessness. Because time is part of the form. Mm-hmm. Time and space. So the form, the thinking mind, the rational lefty mind is designed to create the experience of space so that we feel separation from mm-hmm. bodies and things, and the experience of time. So we experience the separation of discrete moments. So instead of just experiencing an eternal now, we experience like a now, and then a now, and the other now we call the past, and this is the present, and then another now, and now we have two pasts, and then, you know, the next now is the future. So this creation of this idea of time and experience of space falls off mm-hmm. in this kind of non-dual experience of just pure presence. So you can be in, you know, in this kind of space in the temporal sense for a minute and it can feel like an hour. You can be there for an hour and it can feel like a minute. Right. Other attempts to describe this as like flow, or it's just different concept, but they overlap a tiny bit. So anyways, it's not something that you can really do. It happens. So when your mind is ready, right, the ego structures are ready to get out of the way and they're comfortable enough to allow yourself to do this, your higher self to do this, then it'll just happen. It's kind of like an apple won't fall from the tree until it's ripe. But the ripening process is just as important as the falling from the tree, right? You can't rush it, in other words. Yeah. Right? Or like, just use our mountains example, climbing the five mountains, right? Just getting, you know, the last step to get to that peak is not the most important step. Nor is I would say the first step, right, is probably the most important, because that's like your commitment. But every step in between is equally important, because it's moving you toward, right, that peak. So similarly, you can't really, this is a point where you don't strive anymore. Attention control, arousal control, concentration, even mindfulness is an active process. But what we're talking about here, let's call it non-dual awareness, or trying to touch the void, you know, there's different words for it, big mind. It's just total surrender. Yes. Right? You're willfully looking for awareness itself, and then you surrender until your mind is ready to let go of the grip of the formless, time-based, linear reality and allow you to taste that one mm-hmm. taste of the non-dual world, the non-dual aspect of our very nature. Mm-hmm. So, the more advanced practitioner, right, will then just sit with it and turn the light around. And that's the fourth phase of my practice. And what's cool about that is anytime when it happens, which now anytime I try it, I come back with some sense of knowing this.
Yeah.
About my life, about this day, about whether I'm on track, about whether I'm off track. Right? Because that's, you're touching into your spiritual energy, your spiritual center, your soul's desires, I guess, the reason you're here on this planet, your archetypal calling. And it's a powerful thing. So not only have you freed yourself from physical issues through your physical training, physical mountain, but now you've freed your mind from dysfunctional patterns, fear-based patterns, the conditioning and training of other people, to where now you're in total control of your mind. And because the mind includes the heart and the belly, now you're getting into the emotional mountain work of, you know, clearing up trauma patterns, right? Shadow work. It can all happen through this practice, but then generally we teach that, you know, it's good to get some support, like from a therapist or, you know, a really good emotional coach.
Our consciousness sometimes. Doctor.
Very helpful. Very good, right? Needed.
Very helpful. And then you begin to experience the opening of the intuition centers, and you can spur those on through this morning ritual practice. And then when you touch that non-dual or that kind of source energy, that's where your insight as to who you are and why you're on this planet. You know, that dangerous question of who am I, you're going to find the answer there. Yes. You know, so my example from that and why I know that's a true statement is, you know, I wasn't able to describe what I just described to you back when I was 21, 22, 23, meditating with Mr. Nakamura. But it all happened. Mm-hmm. And he didn't teach it. It just happened. I was able now through, you know, 40 some odd years of continued practice and really, really trying to understand what the heck is going on here. And a lot of trial and error. I now understand, like, oh, that's the process, right? That's like that's the curriculum to follow. You don't jump to mindfulness like most people are trying to do because you're jumping the line. There's a definite sequence that you need to follow.
Yes.
Right. But so I followed my own sequencing and I fumbled my way there, but I must have karmically had some training in a past life, mm-hmm. or else I wouldn't have been led to Zen at 21 years old. Right. And I would never have been able to develop all the creative expression of things that I have today. Right. And so I think I must be continuing, right, a journey of teaching or of yoga mastery. I don't know. I haven't had like insights into past lives, except that I've been a warrior for many lifetimes. So that's probably why I was drawn to that. You know,
you're definitely somebody that holds a lot of wisdom and keeps teaching. And that's not the first time you share that wisdom. Now it's just different words, but the concepts are always the same. And I love what you just shared. And it's just like how you describe mindfulness. That's how real mindfulness works. Like many people do it like, I always explain it. You're staying in that one room and observing the room all the time. You're just desensitized. But that is not mindfulness. That is, in my words, BS. You have to step out of the room and then create a real room and then start through mindfulness, being present and getting out of the time loops.
Right.
And time is just another explanation of space.
Right.
And it just creates that density, like you so perfectly explained. And as soon as you mastered that and understood that that is a real concept, quantum principles are livable.
Right.
You just step out of the story, be in a new event, and just gather the meaningful lessons. And then you step into the next event and just take the meaningfulness and the rest, just leave it behind. It wasn't necessary at all. And maybe not even yours.
Right. I love what you said. And I think quantum physics has really helped the understanding that time and space are actually the same, different vantage points, right? Of the same thing. One is like the wave and one's the particle. You know what I mean? But they exist for a reason, right? So when people, I think people can get a little confused that when they do this kind of work, that suddenly they're going to be transported someplace else. And this is where you get spiritual bypassing.
Yes.
You get people checking out of society and joining, you know, ashrams and, you know, going to the caves in Tibet thinking, oh, this is how I'm supposed to live. And they're missing the point, right? That no, yes. Like you are wherever you are, there you are. Mm-hmm. Life is where you're at.
Exactly. Like
the yoga tradition said that actually a much more challenging path is just to be a householder, you know, and have jobs, right? And to main and still do the work. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to be an incredible gift to everybody else as you become more aware and awakened to your awakened awareness and open your heart. And then you can bring compassion and loving kindness into your relationships and help be in service. And that's, so you're combining, you know, the fastest path to ripening the apple. If you feel like suddenly like I feel like I'm in a hurry. Well, that's fine. Like strive, but don't expect the apple to drop before it's ripe. But if you really want to like go all in, then this combination or integration of training the mind through Jnana Yoga, that's the path of wisdom, mm-hmm. opening and expanding your heart, which is devotional bhakti yoga, right? Through loving kindness, through compassion, through forgiveness, or just pure devotion to a divine, you know, aspect that resonates with you, right? It could be the divine mother, it could be Gaia, it could be Christ, but it doesn't matter. And then karma yoga, which is service. So by doing good works and serving others selflessly, right, you're going to accrue positive energy, positive karma. Combining these three in a way that is uniquely you. Mm-hmm. But this is what the Bhagavad Gita, one of the most treasured spiritual texts, is all about. It's about this idea that, you know, you have to, even if you have a serious practice and dedication to mastering yourself like Arjuna did. So he had practiced, you know, Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. He was really, you could tell he was a Bhakti Yogi because he didn't want to hurt his cousins who were on the, you know, raid on the battle against him because they had taken over the kingdom.
Yes.
And he didn't want to go kill these people. Right. And Krishna, who's representing the charioteer who represents God, you know, has a little chat with him and says, you know what, Arjuna, like, you are a warrior. Like, that's your calling in this life. That's your archetypal energy. And if you don't fight, if you don't fulfill your purposes and mission, then you're going to bring more suffering into your life for the rest of your life because you'll have regrets and whatnot. And you'll accrue negative karma and you'll end up having to come back and learn the lesson. Hmm. So even though he was dedicated to ahimsa, peace or nonviolence, he, you know, you have to fulfill your calling or else you're doing yourself harm. And so let's say my calling was to be a warrior and a teacher, but I love just sitting on the meditation bench and I'm like, I'm going to go off to Japan and join a Zen tradition and just practice martial arts. And that's all I did. And then I would have been accruing negative karma because I would have missed my calling.
100%.
So it's really important to spend the time in silence and tap into that source energy and to clarify, like, why are you on this planet? And then go do something about it. Don't hide from it.
Exactly. And just going to these places, it's so way easier to be in a cave and meditate. There is no distraction.
That's way easier. But you're, you know, I always love, I've spent a little time in those places and, I know we all obviously know this from like stories about, you know, like religious orders, right? That they're just rife with drama. Yeah, you know, sexual dysfunction, all sorts of, you know, passive aggressiveness. So you're going to take your bullshit with you wherever you go.
Yes.
And why not, you know, stay in the world if that's your calling and work through that stuff? Yes. Do the work. Don't hide from the world. That's my point. People have this spiritual bypass. And this has happened now with a lot of psychedelic use that is not wisely done. People little will just kind of like think, well, everything is bliss. Everything is one. We're all one. And so I'm just going to live over there. But my point was there's no there. The there is here.
Yes.
So I mean, one of the Zen patriarchs said there is absolutely no distinction between the unmanifest and the manifest world.
Yes.
No distinction.
It's all visible. We just don't see.
You can't see it all. This is a really important distinction. Glad you said that. Mm-hmm. Non-physical doesn't mean unmanifest. It just means you can't see it, experience it. Like a human being, untrained, can only see 0.5% of the electromagnetic spectrum. But as you train your mind, you can open the aperture. And some people who have like special powers like ESP or, you know, sensory perception or clairvoyance or whatnot, it's just because somehow their brain was wired to have a little bit more open aperture where they can take in and see more, right? So you can train yourself, right, to both see more and also you can train yourself with a lot of very specialized training to, you know, do pretty wild things because you're tapping into the quantum, right? Yes. Yes. And so exactly. We know this from the cities or special powers, like in Patanjali talks about in his Yoga Sutras, making yourself light enough to walk on water. Sounds like someone I know. you can make yourself heavy as heavy as a mountain, so you're immovable. Well, that would be useful if you're a warrior, right? To be able to leave your body. So this sounds a lot like astral travel, but to deliberately do it. And to be able to be in two places at one time, or to be able to enter the consciousness of another human being and to experience their world. Sounds pretty spooky. I wonder if it's ever happened to me. People will say, well, that sounds like, some entity taking your... No, it's a yogic skill. But, Patanjali warns about those because they can be traps of the ego. So you don't want to, yes. You don't want to set out to develop like, hey, I want to do some yogic flying. That's a waste of time. As you develop yourself, some powers may come, and then you're just going to keep on training. You don't want to get attached to them because then they'll take you off your path. Right. Because then those will be trappings of the ego. And I'm not sure how I went down that rabbit hole, but it was a master point I was trying to make, but I think it wandered off the reservation there.
But it's beautiful.
Yes, it is. Wow. And this has played a big role in your own healing journey, your own wellness journey, and you being able to set yourself up for success for if there is a stressor or trauma in your wellness journey, then you're able to still have that deep state of wellness, profound wellness that you're integrated with at your very core, right. And your cells respond in a profound healing capacity because of that. So if you'd be open to share about your recent wellness.
Sure. All right. I'd be happy to. It's obviously very present in my life, but the point you make is really important, right? So as you do this work, you can get really healthy. You can get really emotionally aware and have great relational, work with your spouse and others. You can be like a master, right? And shit will still happen. Life still happens.
Next level is waiting.
Right? And sometimes the challenges can even get more extreme because you're more capable. So you're ready for them, right? And so there's a quickening. The experience of quickening is like, okay, consciousness, spirit, or like even your higher self, however you want to describe that. The master plan for your life has a bunch of forks in it. And if you take the fork that's going to get you more and more aware, then guess what? That fork is going to have like some significantly more challenges so that you can become even more aware. Right. So the more capable you are, the bigger the challenges because you're able to handle them. Because ultimately there's people say, some people don't think you have a purpose in life. And I obviously disagree with that. I think everyone has this archetypal purpose. Like it's like saying there's no reason or every flower is going to be exactly the same. No. You look out in your flower field, they're all different, but they're all flowers. So human beings are like that. We all are different. We all have a different purpose, even if it's just to sit on the, sit and do nothing. That's fine. If that's your purpose, do it well. Right? So that's one. You all have a reason for your expression.
Exactly.
But even beyond that, the master purpose of being human is to evolve.
Yes.
It's to evolve, right? And so if you're really far along your evolutionary journey, like this, the yogis would say, it takes 1,000 lifetimes to find yoga. Mm-hmm. So if you're a yogi, like a true yogi, meaning like you understand the eight limbs and the developmental path and you're really committed to it, congratulations. It took you 1,000 lifetimes to find this. And once you find it, you never unfind it.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or another beautiful kind of corollary is the Buddha said that just upon hearing of enlightenment is a real miracle in your life. Right? You can't unhear it. Mm-hmm. And just the hearing about it can be what sets you on your path. Right? So anyways, my point is that oftentimes there's a quickening the more farther along in the journey you are because you're capable, you're competent, and you're ready for it. Yeah. Anyway, so back to your question. I had one of those moments recently. I was invited to, for 3 years, this guy, friend of mine, not like more of a business associate, had been inviting me to Canada to go on his snowmobile trip. And I remember, you know, my dad had this Ski-Doo in 1974, and it went about 30 miles an hour, you know, tooling around, always breaking down. That was my experience snowmobiling. So I was sort of intrigued. And also the way he described it to me sounded like hut skiing with a snowmobile. Like enjoying nature, stopping at these really nice places where you get, you know, a little food and drink and spend the night, go on your journey the next day. Sounded nice to me, actually. But I was in my getting my doctorate, so I just finished my PhD in global leadership and change
from
Pepperdine University. So for 4 years, I was, as you guys know, deep down in the woods. It's a lot of work. I'd rather go back through SEAL training than go get another PhD. So he contacted me right after I kind of did my final defense. Right, I should have known, right? That right there, like the timing was too perfect. So I passed my final defense and everything else is kind of like final wrap up, APA review and everything. And he says, "Hey, Mark, I'm doing that snowmobile trip in February. Would you like to come?" And I was like, "Okay, I can do that." So I find myself in northern Quebec, Canada. Like the first morning, it's 20 below zero. And I'm, you know, I've been in San Diego now since 1990 when I came up. I spent those 4 years in New York studying with Nakamura and getting my CPA MBA. I got it all. I got my MBA, I got my CPA, I got my first degree black belt. In 1989, I left it all behind to join the Navy SEALs because my meditation practice revealed to me that I was meant to be a warrior. That happened from that non-dual kind of tapping in. Mm-hmm. So that sent me on this whole Navy SEAL career thing. And anyways, it's 20 below zero. So I've been in San Diego since 1990 when I went through BUDS. And my body has adapted, right, to the temperate weather. And I'm thinking to myself, why did I agree to do this? Like, it's freezing here. And I'm bundled up in this looks like a spacesuit, right? And they've rented these sleds that are like, look like rockets. And they are rockets. And so this is supposed to be 4 days of you know, out doing this. And the first 4 hours, I'm like hanging on for dear life, going like 80 miles an hour, trying to keep up with this guy. All these groomed trails, which just were made for speed. And I'm already going like, oh gosh, I don't know if I want to do 4 days of this. Like, I was a Navy SEAL for 20 years. I don't need this kind of like adrenaline rush.
I can definitely imagine that.
And so then we get into this wooded area and he's still hauling butt, right? Like, he's going like 50 miles an hour and I can barely see the snow from, you know, his sled kicking out of the turn ahead. And I'm afraid I'm going to lose him and get lost, you know? And so there's all this stuff welling up in my mind and I'm using my breath control and my skills to be like, okay, don't worry about it. You got this. And I would have been fine, except I round this corner and another snowmobile is coming right at me, like in my lane.
Ouch.
And he doesn't make any attempt to move. And so I'm like, I obviously go over to the right to try to pass him. But, you know, I just didn't have the skill and there wasn't enough space. And my sled kind of caught a ditch. And next thing you know, I'm flying off the sled 40 miles an hour.
Oh my God.
And you know, the really wise man thought that came to my head was, oh shit. My life didn't flash before my eyes. Right? I didn't see any angels or anything. I just said, oh shit. Like, this isn't going to go well no matter what. I mentioned to you before the podcast that my lifetime of martial arts, I think, two plausible explanations. And since I'm talking to you guys, I can say the second one with a straight face. The first one, and they're both probably true, is I have this life of martial arts training where, you know, I'm always used to like rolling, and I would always roll on my right shoulder because I'm right-handed. So in that moment that I flew off and I said, oh shit, I knew instinctively, unconsciously, I didn't have this conscious thought that if I hit my head, I'm dead.
Yes.
And so I tucked and rolled. The second plausible explanation is that a guardian angel pressed pause, took my body and went like this, and then pressed start again. And then I hit the tree. So I hit a tree going about 40 miles an hour. But I didn't hit my head, and I didn't hit my spine, but I hit my shoulder and scapula. And I remember, so then just laying in the snow and staring up, and I'm looking at beautiful sky, some snow kind of dropping off the trees, these beautiful trees, and it's dead silent. And the other snowmobile had kept going.
What? Okay.
Know, right? Right? The other guy kept going. And I'm just laying there. And my first thought I had was, I know I'm not dead because I don't think heaven looks like Canada.
Okay, that is brilliant.
All the snow in heaven.
Nothing against Canada, but I don't think heaven looks
Guardian like angel, come back. That's wrong. Okay.
You dropped me off in the wrong heaven.
And I knew I wasn't concussed because I was thinking clearly. Because I know what a concussion feels like. It's really awful, right? And then I was able to wiggle my arms or my toes and my fingers and kind of move my legs and arms. And I was like, oh, shit, I've got all my limbs. Oh, I'm alive. I'm not concussed. And I'm not paralyzed. And I just felt so grateful. And I just sat there just kind of in that energy like, oh, what a lucky fucking day. What a lucky guy I am. Like, wow. Like, I'm... There must be a reason that I was spared there, you know, and even then in that critical moment, of course, I couldn't feel the damage that was done. You know, I was naive enough to think maybe I would got away scot-free or, you know, I could feel a little bit of pain in my shoulder. So maybe I dislocated my shoulder. That was super naive thinking, but I just had this gratitude. I was like, oh, I'm not going to waste this. This lesson, this happened for a reason, and it's going to be a rich opportunity for growth and awakening. And so I'm not going to waste this. I've been given a second chance. And I've had near-death experiences. I mean, not like leaving the body, but I mean like I had a parachute accident where I could easily have been killed. I got stuck in an escape trunk of a submarine and running out of oxygen. I could easily have been killed there. Right? I've been shot at and the bullet whizzing by my ear. I could have easily been killed there. But nothing like this. Right? Nothing like this. Anyways, so I then, my friend finally realizes that I'm not behind him. I'm laying there for 10 minutes. Finally, I hear a snowmobile that comes up and finds me and calling my name. And he says, can you get up? And I tried to get up. I'd already tried to get up. I'm like, nah, I need some help. Mm-hmm. So he got me up. I tried to get on my snowmobile to ride it back. I said, I can't go on. I need to get back to a hospital, see what's going on. But I couldn't lift my arm to put it on the, like, oh shit. So I ended up riding on the back, you know, with my left hand holding it 45 minutes, like jostling through this. I'm like, And I went to the Canadian hospital. We had to finally figure out how to get there. Like we got to this road where there was like a little sort of lodge and there were some cars there and none of them spoke any English. They pride themselves on speaking French and a lot of them don't learn English. And we asked someone if they could bring me to the hospital. They just drove off. Like, thanks. We finally found someone who could call like their 911 for us and got an ambulance out there. They took me to this small regional hospital and you know, Canadian healthcare, right? You don't want to be in a hurry. No. First thing they did was charge me $1,200, and I was like, "Is that because of the tariffs?" I said, "I thought healthcare was free up here." They said, "Free for us, not for you."
Welcoming.
Thinking, you know, I'll be seen. You know, because we've all been in the emergency room, and here in the United States, you know, you're usually not going to wait for more than an hour or two. That's a long time for some. 9 hours.
Oh no.
Okay, so. Imagine, you know, what I'm about to tell you, for me, 9 hours. And so I'm box breathing, you know, and I've got this really sturdy frame from a lifetime of training. And so, and I've got a smile on my face because I got to maintain a positive attitude. And so they have no idea what's going on here. They think, oh, he just rolled off his snowmobile and got an owie. I'm asking them for, like, do you have any pain meds? Sorry, you can't have any pain meds until you get seen by the doctor. And I'm, you know, like, finally, I'm like, really, you gotta have some pain meds. And they said, here's a couple Tylenol. So 9 hours, I finally hear my name called in French to go somewhere, which I had no idea where. And I'm wandering around the hospital trying to find this room. And I finally have to find someone to speak English. I'm like, where am I supposed to go? It was hilarious. So I finally find the room where the X-ray and MRI is. And they're waiting for me, of course. And they do the X-ray and the MRI. And then they send me back out. And I'm thinking, oh, God, here another 9 hours is going to go by. 15 minutes later, the doctor comes running out. He's, Mark, get in here. Holy shit. Because you're not going anywhere. Like, you have shattered your scapula into 18 places and broken 8 ribs, and you have a pneumothorax, right, which is a punctured lung.
Oh my gosh, still doing. And you know, too.
He didn't mention all the other internal damage that could have happened. And I said, "Great. Does that mean I can get some pain meds now?" Really? Because, yeah, get in that bed over there. Nurse, put some morphine in. I'm like, oh my God.
Now take a deep breath.
Exactly. Anyways, long story short, I couldn't fly home. My wife flies out to Quebec City and it's snowstorms back east. This happened in early February. And she's a Southern California girl born in Coronado. Like, you don't want her driving in snow. You know what I mean? Nobody should be driving those snowstorms. They're gnarly back east. And so we decided the best way for me to get home. And I wanted to come back to San Diego to get the surgery, you know, because emergency surgery was required, but like, I wasn't going to die. I didn't think. They didn't think so either. And they said, as long as you get it within 10 days, you know, you're okay, right? It's not, they can't do it right away anyways, because the trauma, I just need to, yeah. It's best to do it like 5 or 10 days later. So we decided to take a train back to San Diego to go to UCSD Trauma Center. Okay. And so we take this train all the way to Detroit, and then we cross the border at like midnight. And it's funny, the Border Patrol agent like finally realized I was telling the truth. I was like, yeah, I shattered my shoulder in a snowmobile accident and trying to get home to San Diego. And he's like, good God, man. Like, sorry to hear that. You know, normally they're like, what's your purpose for entering the United States? And he's like, he was really cool, actually. And then we boarded the train in Detroit on our way to San Diego, but it changed to the sleeper car in Chicago. So we get all the way to Chicago, and I get off the train, and I make the mistake of trying to like pull my bag down with me.
Oh no.
Even though my wife is, you know, she's like a Sherpa now. She's got backpack in the front, backpack in the back, 2 roller bags. Well, I wanted to be helpful. You know, I'm a Navy SEAL. And so I was to get my own bag off the train, and it repunctured my lung, and I'm standing on the, and Sandy's already gone, right? She's like hauling my stuff. And like 3 or 4 minutes later, she realizes I'm not behind her. She turns around and I'm standing there looking at her like these deer in the headlight eyes. I'm
like, oh my gosh.
I can't move. I can't breathe. Like, holy shit. I think this is where we stay.
Yeah.
And so we got another ambulance. They said, well, you want to go to the VA hospital? I said, no, take me to the best trauma center around. And they took us to Rush Hospital, which takes care of a lot of like pro athletes from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And it's a teaching hospital like UCSD is, University of California, San Diego. So they get a lot, they've got a lot of good guys there. They examined me, said, fuck yeah, that's exactly, we got to get surgery. So they scheduled surgery. I got examined on a Friday, scheduled surgery for Monday. And this New Zealand guy did the work. And so he was amazing. Columbia undergrad, Harvard med. And he said, I'm not going to sugarcoat this, Mark. Like, this is a serious industry. But I really love challenges. And I love fixing things.
Yours is definitely
one. I think I can do this. And so he, 3.5-hour surgery, they cut my entire back open on my right side, you know, peeled all the muscles back. And he was able to, you know, put all this hardware, it looks like an erector set, put all this hardware in there to pull these big pieces of the scapula together and to try to align it right with the shoulder, where the shoulder bone meets. And that was February 10th.
Oh my gosh.
So it's been slowly healing. I will regain 100% functionality because I intend to. But it's gonna take some work. It's going to take probably 9 months. I'm only 2 months into it. I can barely lift my arm up to shoulder height, and everything is still really sensitive. Think about the impact trauma.
Oh my gosh!
To my heart and lungs, internal organs, my voice. My voice isn't normally like this. Mm-hmm. I think there was some nerve damage. But I consider it a great blessing, as I mentioned, because I feel like I was prepared for this. Right. Yes. And so that means, okay, I don't want another lesson like this. But I was ready for it, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Even the doctor said this would have killed a lesser man.
Yes.
That is impressive. And especially to not get like deep mental and emotional trauma, your first response, like actually calming down and not freaking out. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the greatest
people said, didn't you get post-traumatic stress from this thing? And I was like, no, I don't experience that because I just, all the tools, everything I teach, not only was I pre-resilient, right? Because I've been meditating and breathing and, you know, doing all the physically training since I've been, as long as I can remember. So that was developed resiliency, which means you'd be ready for this stuff, bounce back quickly. But I also deployed the tools immediately, right? Gratitude, awareness, breath, deep breathing practice, mindful. Like I mentioned earlier, like pain is a great way to activate mindfulness because you just have to be like every breath. Wow. Like, I'm still here. I am not the pain. I am not this body. This body is experiencing pain.
Yes. Wow. And that gratitude that you showed immediately for your body and for the fact that you were okay and at least still alive, you hadn't lost a limb or hit your head. That gratitude immediately started that profound healing, innate healing as well.
That is right, because the positive energy is going to help your body get stronger. Like positive energy strengthens you, negative energy weakens you.
Yes.
So if I'd gone all negative and fearful and woe is me, why did this happen? Mm-hmm. I'm just slowing down and delaying the healing process.
Hmm. Like the olds were saying, pain is inevitable, but suffering is.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, suffering is optional. Yeah. Maharaj says, compassion is the refusal to suffer for imaginary things.
Brilliant.
I love that. Brilliant.
You have to really think about that one to unpack it. But so I think since the accident, I feel like there's been an opening even further. Like greater clarity about why I'm here. You know, of course, the second chance. So I mean, like, take it seriously. One day, one lifetime. Like, get serious.
Yes.
And that means I need to reorganize my business a certain way. It's been trying to emerge, but it wasn't clear to me. You know, get serious about things that maybe I was not paying attention to in my relationships and my wife and my son, like, because I was brought up in a pretty dysfunctional, negative family. So one of those things was, and this is not uncommon, but is to look at what's wrong instead of what's right. Mm-hmm. And so I did have a pattern where I was like, oh, you know, this could be better. That could be better. Instead of like, wow, this is incredible what we have. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful practice in and of itself.
Yes, it is.
So that shifted in me. This feeling of being always witnessing has deepened. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. Mm-hmm. Yes. I make no claims about anything, you know, spiritual related. I just can express my experience. And so my experience is that I have this capacity to be the observer at all times, to include when I see trauma-informed childhood patterns rearing their head in my own consciousness, wanting to, like, take charge and just being able to laugh at that. I'm like, oh, there that is again. There's a little mark. Or there's a pattern from my dad, or there's a pattern from my mom. Mm-hmm. That's freedom. Right. Yes. Ultimately, what we're all striving is to fulfill our purpose and to evolve. And evolution is toward greater and greater freedom.
Absolutely.
Perfect words.
This story has touched me so much, and I know it's touched so many listeners. And the wisdom that you're sharing, your perspective, and how you've shifted the energy towards this profound realization and this understanding. You have so much good that you're bringing into this world, and you're impacting so many. And grateful.
Stay focused and just do what I do, right? Same with you guys.
Yes.
We're all a team of teams trying to bring more love and light in the world.
Absolutely.
And humble and inspiring. And that is, I think, the most important. Just to show through presence rather than preaching.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you guys.
Thank you so much. We are so thankful for you.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
And to all of our listeners on the Resonant Life podcast, we're so grateful that you spent this time with us. And I'll be sharing in the show notes ways that you can shout to Dr. Mark Devine. And congratulations on finishing out your PhD.
That's the first time I've heard that on a podcast.
Congratulations to the doctor.
Definitely. It's hard work. And you dedicated your time and energy into it. And we're so grateful that you've stepped up in so many ways and you've brought so much love and light to this world and to our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a great honor.
Thank you.